Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
Even without medical training, she could observe that every few beats an irregular peak was recorded. Sometimes it was missing, at other times it was too soon, and sometimes it was higher than the others. An LPN inserted a urinary catheter, and Deidre saw a bag attached to the side of the bed begin to collect an amber solution. Then the girl was covered with a warming blanket. An ER doctor who looked like he was hardly old enough to be out of high school entered the room and observed the cardiogram as it was being made. I want a 1,000 mil, 99 degree normal saline drip started. Do not leave her side, and call me when it has been totally infused. He left the room without saying another word and ignored Deidre. The nurse hurried away, leaving her alone with the girl she had rescued. Tears came to her eyes as she looked at the helpless child laying on the table, and she tugged the blanket up a little higher in a feeble effort to help. A med tech came in, carrying her tray of tools. She broke open a packet and produced a needle attached to a tube. She palpated the girl's forearm, located a vein near her wrist, and inserted the needle into a virtually non-existent vein. Deidre winced when the needle went in, but the tech matter-of-factly taped it in place, flushed it with saline, and left the room. On to the next patient, Deidre imagined. Her nurse returned, carrying an IV bag, and with no hesitation hung it on a stand and connected it to the port the med tech had inserted. Deidre could see fluid begin to drain down the tube into the girl's thin arm. In 15 minutes, the bag was nearly empty, and the nurse retreated to the main desk for a few seconds. She returned with the ER doctor. By now, the monitor registered a temperature of 98 degrees. The EKG had fewer anomalies, and her heart rate had risen to 55. "I think she's coming out of the woods," the doctor stated, relief evident in his voice. "Looks like we won't need a saline lavage. Young people always respond quicker than the elderly do. By the looks of it, she's been through a lot." He turned to Deidre. "Are you the adult in charge of this juvenile?" he asked with an accusatory tone. Deidre shook her head. Then she identified herself, producing her badge. She went on to explain the happenings leading up to the girl having been brought to the ER. "Will I be able to speak with her in the morning?" she queried. "Possibly. However, I've called in a child abuse specialist. There's a pediatrician who works out of the cities, Mark Krovich, who's hired by the state to investigate this type of case. He'll be here this evening to make an assessment of the patient's condition. Your request will have to go through him. You can wait for him tonight or see him in the morning before he returns to Minneapolis. Either way, it'll be his call." Deidre opted to wait until morning. She wanted to check with Jeff, and she surmised he might have returned to his office. Jeff stuck his head into the emergency room. "Is she alive?" he questioned, expecting the worst. Deidre filled him in on what she knew. "I need a lift back to the center. Will you give me a ride?" After Jeff pulled into his parking space, the two of them walked to his office together. "What do you think, Deidre? There must be a link between that girl and your murder victim. There seem to be too many similarities to ignore. Between the two of us, I think we have our hands full." Deidre paused when they reached his office. "I know you're understaffed, but I think it might be wise to place a guard at her hospital door. I can't believe her assailant is the only person who wants her dead. I may be overreacting, but whatever is going on is not going to stop. I'm sure of that." Jeff looked at her in surprise. "I hadn't even thought along those lines, but of course I didn't have anything to do with the murder you discovered a couple of weeks ago. And you're right. Better safe than sorry. I'll have a deputy up there in a short while. Thanks for catering to me. How about you? Have you found out anything about the guy who went over the cliff?" "So far, not much," Jeff answered, shaking his head in puzzlement. "As you can imagine, his body was pretty broken up from the fall, but he did have a wallet in his pocket with an ID. His name's Jason Leader. The interesting thing about him, his address is Thunder Bay, Ontario. I ran his name through our database. I'm pretty sure he's not a U.S. citizen." That information took Deidre by surprise, and she saw another thread to her case form. The coincidences kept piling up. Another job for Jill, she thought. On her way home to Inga's, she phoned her office. "You have reached the office of BCA Officer Deidre Johnson. This is Jill Dobers, her secretary, speaking. How may I help you?" This was the first time Deidre had heard her answer the phone and was startled at her professionalism. "Hello?" Jill said again, wondering if her caller had hung up. "Oh, sorry, Jill," Deidre said, a little embarrassed at being taken aback. "This is Deidre." "Hey, boss lady, how are you? I worried about you when I heard there was a problem on Palisade Head. You okay?" Again, Deidre was slow to answer. She hadn't expected Jill to be concerned about her welfare. I'm fine. Just really tired. I know it's late in the day, but could you run a check on a Jason Leader? He lives in Thunder Bay." She gave Jill the street address. "We're pretty sure he's not a U.S. citizen, so you might begin with the Thunder Bay authorities first. I'm going home to try to get some rest. See you in the morning." "Bye, boss lady. Take care of yourself. We need you on this case." Deidre had to smile as she closed her cell phone, ending the call. Inga had some kind of hot dish on the stove, and its aroma made Deidre's mouth water. "Deidre, I was hoping you'd get home in time for supper. You must be cold and hungry after such a long day. Sit down." Inga pulled a chair out from the table and motioned her to sit. The table was already set. Inga dished a helping of food onto both plates. Heat rose from the concoction of hamburger, potato chunks, sliced onions, and carrots smothered in some kind of tomato sauce. She sliced thick slabs of bread from a loaf fresh out of the oven and poured a cup of steaming coffee. Over supper, Deidre shared with Inga the story of her trek up Palisade Head, but she gave no information about why she was up there or what she had found, only that it had been bitter cold and hard work. "I'm going to lie down on the couch, if that's okay. I'd like to grab a few minutes of sleep. Wake me in half hour. We can talk more this evening." She curled up and put a down lap robe over her. After a few minutes, she flipped over, trying to get comfortable, but images she could not erase from her mind kept her from rest. A half hour later, Inga gently placed her hand on Deidre's shoulders. She hadn't slept a wink. "Do you want to wake up, dear?" the older woman asked. Deidre reluctantly sat up. "I couldn't sleep, Inga. I think I'm going to check on someone in the hospital." She got up and pulled on her parka. "I don't think I remember a November this cold, ever," she said as she closed the outside door behind herself. Deidre rang the buzzer and was admitted to the ER entryway. "Has Dr. Hrovich been here?" she asked at the nurse's station. "He's with a patient right now. Do you want me to tell him a relative is here?" The nurse was young. "No, that's all right. I'll wait for him to finish. My name's Deidre Johnson. I'm with the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I want to learn what he has discovered about the girl we brought in today. How is she doing?" "She's stable," the receptionist answered noncommittally. "There's hot coffee in the waiting room." Deidre filled a cup and sat in a chair, looking off into space and seeing nothing. The next thing she knew, the nurse was touching her shoulder. "Dr. Hrovich would like to speak to you in the conference room." Deidre looked at her watch. An hour had passed since she took a seat, and she was glad she had set the cup of coffee down before falling asleep. A kindly-looking man rose to greet her when she entered the conference room. "Hello, I'm Mark. Before I tell you what I've discovered, may I check your ID? Just a precaution." After Deidre had produced her badge and picture ID, he motioned her to sit opposite him at the end of the table. He placed his fingers to his temples and closed his eyes for a minute. "I don't quite know where to begin, except to say that we are dealing with one of the worst cases of abuse I have ever witnessed. We might as well begin with some very unusual bruising I found. There is little doubt but that she was manacled by her left ankle to prevent her from escaping. The marks left by the ring are unmistakable. Bruising would indicate she was handled very roughly, although I couldn't find evidence of her being beaten by any specific object such as a club or a whip." He paused again to massage his temples. "She has been sexually abused. Evidence points to repeated assaults. And also, she tested positive for gonorrhea. If that isn't enough, her feet are lacerated from running through snow and over ice while barefoot. Her hands show signs of frostbite, and she's extremely malnourished. Like I said, this is about the worst case of abuse I've seen in over 10 years on this job." He shook his head and went back to kneading the sides of his head. Deidre saw a tear trickle down his cheek, and he blew his nose on a tissue. "Will I be able to speak with her in the morning?" Deidre wanted to know, but not wanting to sound pushy, considering the girl's condition. "You can try. I'll still be here, and we can see her together. However, I must warn you that right now she's so traumatized that she's in a stupor. She doesn't respond to any stimuli, not sound, not lights, not even pinpricks. She is totally withdrawn into a world somewhere else. I'm sorry, I wish I could give you more. Deirdre drove home in the cold. It was beginning to snow heavily, and she thought it was shaping up to be a long winter. Chapter 15. The morning dawned cloudy but warmer, the temperature hovering near the freezing mark. Last night's snowfall amounted to about 3 inches of the powdery white stuff, and already water was beginning to drip from the eaves of houses. Deirdre drove straight to the hospital to check on the girl she had rescued. She entered through the main entrance and found the information desk. "May I help you?" the volunteer asked. "Yes, I'd like the room number of a young lady admitted yesterday afternoon. Her room probably has a guard at the door." The volunteer looked through her list of patients. "I need to know the nature of your visit and see your ID before I can release that information. Something pretty dangerous must be going on. I've never had a request like this before." Deirdre produced her BCA badge along with her photo. The volunteer examined the plastic cards intently before handing them back. "She is in room 218. Check in at the nurse's station before going to her room." Deirdre took the stairs. She remembered how slowly the elevator responded and knew she could get there faster by walking. She turned left down the hall and stopped at the nurse's station. A nurse was so intent on his charting that he didn't raise his head. After waiting a few seconds, Deirdre cleared her throat, and he quickly looked up. "I'm sorry, can I help you?" he asked, keeping his finger on the page where he had been writing. "I'd like to visit the patient in room 218. The person at information said to check with you first." "No visitors allowed. Dr. Hrovich is attending her. He left word that only a Deirdre Johnson is to be allowed to see her." Deirdre could see in his eyes that he connected the dots. "Are you Deirdre Johnson?" Deirdre smiled at him, thankful that the doctor had not forgotten. "I am. Can I go to her room now?" "Just a moment, please. I need to see your official ID and your driver's license." She produced both, pleased that security was tight. "Go ahead. Hers is the last door on the right." He motioned the direction for Deirdre to go. The door was marked by a deputy sitting in a chair outside the room, and Deirdre nodded to him as she reached for the doorknob. He leapt from his chair. "I'm sorry, this room is off limits," he ordered, and his hand moved to his hip. He was a young man hired after Deirdre's resignation as sheriff, and it hadn't dawned on her that he had no clue who she was. "It's okay, I'm Deirdre Johnson. I'm with the BCA. Dr. Hrovich is expecting me." "I'm sorry, ma'am. I'll have to see your ID before I can let you in." Again, Deirdre had to fumble through her pocket for the required proof of who she was. The deputy knocked on the door and opened it for her. "Sorry about the stop, ma'am, but orders are orders." Deirdre was a little miffed by the ma'am part. Suddenly, she felt old. Dr. Hrovich was sitting in a chair, staring at the girl. When he looked up, Deirdre noted the dark bags under his eyes. He looked as though he hadn't slept at all. "Hello, Ms. Johnson," he said, not bothering to stand. "Have a seat so we can talk. I'm leaving in a short while, but I'll have a report sent to you tomorrow. In the meantime, we have to decide what we're going to do with this child. I'm quite sure she's of Native American descent. At least her physical characteristics point in that direction. She's been terribly traumatized, so much so that she is completely withdrawn into her own cocoon. Look at her." Deirdre had avoided looking directly at the motionless form lying under the sheet. She forced herself to look. The girl lay on her right side, knees drawn up to her abdomen, her arms wrapped around her chest. Her chin was drawn down onto her sternum, and every now and then her feet twitched in spasms. What was most disturbing to Deirdre were the girl's eyes. They were wide open but not blinking, expressionless, and to Deirdre it appeared that all spark had left them. She looked like a breathing corpse. "I don't know what it'd take to bring her back to this world, or if that is even possible anymore. Last night, I told you about her physical problems, but I can't look into her mind. I'm recommending she be moved to a hospital in Duluth, to a psychiatric ward. She needs the intensive psychological care they can offer. Even then, I'm not sure what can be done. She'll recover from the physical abuse, but I have to believe her mind will be scarred forever." He sighed deeply and then sat still. "I need to do a couple of things, doctor. First, I need to fingerprint her. And second, I need to have a buccal swab taken for a DNA test. Can I do that?" "No need," he responded. "The sheriff was here last evening after the guard was posted, which, by the way, is prudent, I believe, not only to keep intruders out, but also to not allow her to leave if she should revive enough to try and escape. Anyway, he took prints and a sample for testing last night. He seems like a good man. The best, Deirdre said in a quiet voice. The doc continued, part of my job is to testify in trials involving child abuse cases. Catch whoever did this, and I'll crucify him from the witness stand. He sat in silence, looking at his patient, and then forced himself from his chair. I've got to be going. I'm set to testify at 1 o'clock against a father who intentionally scalded his 2-year-old son. Who spawns these wretches, I'll never figure out. Dr. Hrovich left the room without saying goodbye. Deirdre followed him out the door. Good morning, boss lady, Jill's chipper voice sang out as Deirdre entered her office. I've got some info for you that I think might wake you up. Deirdre was getting used to her secretary's greeting. At least she didn't rankle at the words anymore. She poured herself a cup of coffee. I hope it's better news than I've had so far this morning. Yesterday, you asked me to check on this guy, Jason Leader. You were right. He has Canadian citizenship, but that hasn't stopped him from having a record here in the U.S. Check this out. She handed Deirdre a piece of paper, and she quickly scanned down the sheet. June 2, 2006. Implicated in prostitution case. Dismissed from Minnesota 4th District Court. September 9, 2008. Implicated in child pornography case. Dismissed from Minnesota 4th District Court. December 18, 2009. Implicated in prostitution case. Dismissed from Minnesota 4th District Court. July 22, 2010. Arrested with juvenile female in car. Charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Dismissed from Minnesota 4th District Court on technicalities. There are a few other minor infringements recorded. Speeding, disorderly conduct, running a red light. Deirdre ignored those, but she focused on the pattern of offenses that fit the case she was tracking. Jill interrupted her thought. Now here's what you'll want to hear. The judge in each of the possible sex cases was none other than your friend, Tony DeMarcus. Not only that, but Leader's attorney in each case was the same person, Gerald Coulter II. He's the one who represented Billy Evers the time he dodged the bullet and got off without so much as a slap on the wrist. Remember him? He lives here in Two Harbors. Oh, I remember him all right, Deirdre said, disdain dripping from her words, but she didn't elaborate. Tell you what, Jill, it's almost noon. Why don't you take the rest of the day off? Tomorrow's Thanksgiving, and you probably could use the time to get ready. I'm heading to Duluth to spend the evening with a friend and his daughters, and I won't mind getting an early start. That okay with you? Deirdre realized she had just asked permission of her employee to leave work early. I don't have anything planned for tomorrow, Jill said. I'll catch the evening community church service and do some reading tonight. I'll watch the Macy's Thanksgiving parade on TV tomorrow and then some football. Maybe read a little more. Don't you have family? Deirdre queried. There was an uncomfortable pause. Not around here. Well, rest up. My guess is we'll have some heavy lifting on Monday. See you then. The women left the office together, and Jill locked the door behind them. Chapter 16. Deirdre rang the doorbell at Ben's home, and she heard the thump of running feet as the twins raced to be first to the door. She hadn't called ahead to let them know she was arriving earlier than they had planned. Ben would be at work, and the sitter was not expecting her. The door was flung open. Deirdre, the girls shrieked in unison. Deirdre stooped to their level, and they wrapped their arms around her neck so tightly she could hardly breathe. She kissed each on the cheek and tried to walk away, but they continued to hang on her, one on each leg. The sitter stood back, smiling. She had met Deirdre several times and knew how the girls loved her. Is it okay if I'm a little early? Deirdre asked. I needed to get away from work for a while. The sitter laughed. You're a savior. I've got a ton of company coming tomorrow, and I sure can use some extra time to prepare. Then she thought, oh, you are staying, aren't you? It was Deirdre's turn to laugh. You couldn't force me to leave. Anyway, I think you'd have to battle these two. And she ruffled the twins' hair. They looked up at her, grinned, and hung on to her legs more tightly. After the sitter left, Deirdre got down on her knees to be at twin height. Well, what are we going to do until your daddy gets home? I know, let's play dress up, Megan suggested. How about you be the mommy and Marin and I will be your kids? Well, Deirdre hesitated. How do we play this game? Very confidently, Megan continued. Let's pretend you've been with us all, she dragged out the sound, day long. That means that when Daddy comes home, he'd like to see the table set. Let's do that. So far, everything sounded pretty safe, and the three of them busied themselves setting placemats for four, arranging the silverware, although Dieter wasn't quite sure on which side of the plate the fork was placed. It took almost a half hour to complete the task. "So what are we going to do for food?" Dieter wanted to know. "Oh, we can do what we usually do," Marin chimed in. "Pizza." Dieter laughed. "How about we fix something really fancy for when your daddy gets home?" "I know," Megan's eyes lit up. "Peanut butter sandwiches." "Okay," Dieter agreed. "We'll make super peanut butter sandwiches. And how about a salad?" "Do we have to?" the twins complained in unison. Dieter ignored their complaints. "Let's get busy so the food is ready when Daddy comes home. We'll surprise him with a special meal." "I know what would really surprise him," Megan volunteered, her expression serious. "What's that, dear?" "I think he'd be really surprised if you hugged him and gave him a big kiss and said, 'How was your day, honey?'" Dieter was totally blindsided, and she felt as though this had been a perfect setup. Finally, she responded, "Well, I bet that would really surprise your daddy. What do you think he'd do if I did that?" Marin jumped in on cue. "I think he'd be happy." Dieter sat on a chair. "Come here, you two." She placed one child on each knee so she could look into their eyes. "Your daddy is a special man, and he loves the two of you very, very much. You know, I think right now two women in his life are enough for him. When he comes to the door, why don't you run up to him and give him a big kiss on the cheek and say, 'Daddy, I love you so much. Come and see the special dinner we made for you.'" They looked at Dieter a second or two through their large blue eyes. "Okay." They both slid off her lap. Dieter breathed a sigh of relief. "Megan, you get out the toaster, and Marin, you find the bread. When you've done that, show me where you keep the peanut butter." In seconds, the girls had produced the items. "Okay, now we need a fry pan." "A fry pan?" the girls squawked. "Why do we need a fry pan for peanut butter sandwiches?" "Wait and see." Dieter opened the meat keeper in the refrigerator and found an open package of bacon. In minutes, she had several strips sizzling in the pan. The girls began making toast, stockpiling the brown pieces in the warm oven. Dieter threw together a special salad. "Come on, kids, let's make some dessert." With their help, she made instant chocolate pudding and topped it off with fresh raspberries she had brought with her from the grocery store in Two Harbors. "Now we make our sandwiches." She helped them smear on a generous spread of peanut butter and showed them how to layer the crisp bacon strips. "Do you think Daddy will like our sandwiches?" Marin wondered. Before Dieter could answer, they heard Ben stomping the snow from his boots before he stepped into the entryway. The girls went flying to meet him. "Daddy," they cried in unison, and jumped into his arms. "We're having peanut butter sandwiches for supper," Megan proudly announced. Marin added, "With bacon. Do you think you'll like that?" Ben kissed his girls, all the while looking at Dieter and smiling. "You're early. It's so good to see you." "We wanted Dieter to kiss you when you came home, but she's too bashful," Marin announced, and Ben looked embarrassed. "I see. What have you three been talking about while I've been at work?" He gave each girl a pat on the head, then hugged them close. Something snapped inside Dieter when she saw the way that Ben related to his daughters. For an instant, she saw the body of Anna Woodsong and the battered child in a hospital bed. She burst into tears, sobbing uncontrollably. Ben took two steps and was in front of her. She wrapped her arms around his neck and buried her face in his chest, her body convulsing as she tried to get hold of her emotions. Ben held her and stroked her hair with his free hand. "What's wrong?" Megan asked, perplexed. Marin gently placed her hand on the back of Deidre's leg. "Daddy'll fix it, Deidre. He can fix anything." That made Deidre sob all the more. It took several minutes before she could speak. She blew her nose on a tissue and dabbed her eyes. Then she realized Ben still held her, and she slowly pushed away. "Oh, I'm so sorry, girls. I must have scared you. It's just..." And she paused to form her words without beginning to cry again. "It's just that you make me so happy I had to cry tears of happiness. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?" Both girls nodded, but their eyes told the truth. They had no idea why Dieter had burst into tears. She wasn't sure herself what had happened. "Come, let's eat," she said, painting a smile on her face. Ben said grace while they held hands in a circle at the table. "One of my favorites, peanut butter and bacon sandwiches. I'm sure glad you made me too, because I'm so hungry." He took a bite of the sandwich as though it were made of the finest shaved sirloin steak. "I think this is the best peanut butter bacon sandwich I've ever eaten," the little girls beamed. "And this is the best salad I've had too," Dieter laughed. After dessert was finished and the table cleared, Dieter and Ben played Chinese checkers with the kids, helping them to spot the correct moves. Then Ben got out a book and they all sat on the couch, Megan and Marion between Deidre and Ben. It was a kid's poetry book, My Rollaway Bed, about a little girl's magic bed that took her to adventuresome places at night. Okay, bedtime, Ben announced when he finished the last page. We want Deidre to tuck us in, they sang out in unison. Ben carried Marion and Deidre carried Megan up the stairs to their room, and Deidre pulled the covers up around their chins, giving each child a squeeze and a kiss goodnight. I wish you lived here all the time, Marion said, a look in her eyes that could only be described as a plea. Ben turned on their nightlight, and the grown-ups returned to the living room. A glass of wine? Ben asked. That'd be great. After my scene a while ago, I think I need more than that. Tough day, huh? Anything you can tell me? Ben knew there were times in their business when a person simply needed to verbalize the baggage they were carrying. Deidre tried to explain the feelings that had overwhelmed her when she broke down. She explained about the condition of the dead girl and the blank stare of the girl she'd helped rescue. Then she said she had such a feeling of fear for Megan and Marin that it had completely blindsided her. For an instant, she said, she had visions of the twins being violated in the same way, and it seemed far too real for her to face. Ben listened intently, not interrupting once. He knew Deidre had to get this off her chest. When she finally went silent, he spoke. Sometimes I get those same feelings when I watch them at play, but then I realize I'm giving them all the love I can right now, so when they're older, they don't go looking for something they never had growing up. When I become fearful for them, I remind myself I must have faith that what I'm doing with them now is laying the foundation for a lifestyle that'll help them avoid some of life's pitfalls. I know they'll make their own mistakes along the way, but all I can do is direct their lives so those mistakes aren't so tragic that they can't overcome the consequences. After a pause, he added, I hope you realize that you're having a profound influence on them, Deidre. I'll be forever grateful for what you're doing. I believe they're going to have good lives, but thank you for sharing. Sometimes it's good to talk about our problems. Kind of like the sound of music. Then they don't seem so bad. Deidre laughed. Here's to you, Deidre, my friend, my daughter's idol, and a very, very wonderful person. Deidre blushed and lifted her glass in the direction of his. Thank you. Thanksgiving Day was snowy. Deidre was sitting at the kitchen table, coffee cup in hand, and looking out the window when the twins peeked around the doorway at her. Sleep was still in their eyes, and their hair stood out from an accumulation of static electricity. They came running to her. Do you feel better today? Megan wanted to know. We don't want you to be sad, Deidre, Marin chimed in. She got down to their level and hugged them. You girls make me happy. So happy I could just eat you up. And Deidre pretended to nibble on their ears. They squealed in delight. What about Daddy? Megan asked. Does he make you happy?
You've been listening to episode 8 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors here on Literally from the North Shore.